Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me on today's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. And today's guest is going to be one that I'm sure you're really going to enjoy. Dr. Jeffrey Rutledge has a very interesting background in digital health. He's a practicing physician. He's a Stanford-trained medical informatics expert, a former WebMD pioneer, and the co-founder and chief medical officer of HealthTap, where he has spent years working at the intersection of medicine, technology, AI, and virtual care. Dr. Rutledge, welcome to I Don't Care.
Nice to see you, Dr. Stephen. Thank you.
Great to have you. Tell my audience a little bit more about you other than what I just shared.
Well, thank you for that complimentary description. But you're right on in terms of my interest. I see myself as a clinician who understands and uses technology to try and improve the processes of care. That was kind of my mission from the beginning. I was on faculty teaching medicine at Stanford when I quit my faculty job to go do a PhD in medical computing, because I thought, gosh, if I'm going to be able to use technology at the limit of what's possible to do, I should get the best possible training. And I originally did research in the academic setting with NIH-supported researcher, but realized that actually the technology advancement was so rapid that there was huge opportunities to build systems that would improve healthcare and be distributed much more widely. You know, in the academic world, I was on tenure track at Harvard and pursuing research that would lead to academic advancement required a real high degree of focus and specificity and creating world expertise in a very narrow area. But in fact, with the advent of the internet, there was an opportunity to build systems that would be widely applicable and used broadly far more than was possible to do in academia. So I left my academic position. I joined the company that later became WebMD. It was originally called Healthion. And, you know, have had a career that focuses on trying to apply technology to improve the way we give care. We started, you know, the consumer wave with the dot-com world, where we discovered for the first time in those days that medical information would be helpful to people. People had a need for it, and they ought to be able to access it. You shouldn't have to go to a medical school library to get information about health. And this was a new thing back in the 90s when this first occurred. And, you know, I built the first version of what became WebMD as a demonstration of that importance. You know, I later went on to say, well, the same thing applies on the doctor side. Doctors need access freely to information at the point of care. And at Hippocrates, where we were creating an application that delivered information at the point of care to doctors, we demonstrated doctors would use it if it worked. I mean, doctors are very fond of that application to get important information about medications if done right. And I put those two together in starting HealthTap, gosh, 16 years ago now. We said, gee, it ought to be possible to bring the patient and the doctor together using technology to deliver better care. The obviousness of accessibility of care seemed clear. And also the understanding that if you had the doctor and the patient talking together on an electronic platform, you had the opportunity to support and improve. You know, we previously gave consumers information on their side and we gave doctors information on their side. Well, if you had the doctor and the patient together connected, then you can guide and support and improve the process of care. You can give reminders to doctors about things the patient need. You can highlight to the patients the things the doctors recommended that they do that they haven't done yet. And you can just support and improve the care. Plus, as we've demonstrated now at HealthTap, you can make care accessible to people who otherwise simply can't access it. It's not even just people in remote or rural areas that have a distance to travel. There are people in congested areas with lots of doctors around who still have barriers to accessing care. Their doctor may be booked up for months. They could have mobility problems. They could have kids at home that prevent them from leaving the home because daycare is a huge issue. So there are lots of reasons why it's incredibly more accessible for people to be able to connect with a doctor directly from home on their laptop or on their mobile device.
No, you're exactly right. And you just hit a topic that most people don't think of, because they think of telehealth as being a very rural necessity, if you will. But as you said, many large metropolises like a Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex that is highly congested, that, you know, traffic continues to be a real issue. And then, of course, the issue that people are trying to get appointments with their physicians. And oftentimes those could be weeks, if not months out.
Absolutely. And interestingly, there's a couple of other dimensions I think worth mentioning here, Kevin, which is the how people think about telehealth. You know, when it got started, and, you know, we were part of that back in, we were, I think, the first nationwide on-demand urgent care, urgent primary care service available in all states, right? The idea of I have a itch I want to scratch, there's a thing I need and I'm going to get it. The transactional view, it's like digital urgent care. It's like going to an urgent care clinic. I'm going to see whoever's there and the problem I have is going to be solved, right? I've got an earache. I need treatment for that. I've got cough. What could it be? Do I need an x-ray? Whatever. The notion of transactional care was how telehealth got started. And many people still think that's all it is. I mean, I'll share with you that even we, when I got started, I thought of virtual care as a complement to office-based care. That if you see the person in the office, you know them well, you have a relationship, now you can do more virtually. Like you can talk to your patients on the phone if you know them. You can't talk to someone credibly if you don't know them on the phone. And similarly, I thought that virtually would be a complement to office-based care. What came as a revelation to me was discovering that you could meet people virtually and get to know them and understand them. And it's counterintuitive, but when you take away the office and the computer and the nurse in the hall and the examining room behind you, and you just have the connection with the patient, you connect with them in ways that are very powerful and meaningful. And more sometimes than happens in the office where there's so many distractions. And so counterintuitively, you can develop a relationship with the patient where you're learning what's going on in their lives. And you couple that with the realization that most people most of the time don't need an injection, a physical manipulation, or even a physical examination for most problems. And the thing missing from primary care so often is an understanding of lifestyle and risk and preventive care measures. And when you connect with a doctor and all they have is the discussion with you, the most important things happen. The measures of preventive care, understanding what's really causing problems in people's lives is possible when you have a direct conversation. And when your patients are comfortable in a home environment, it's easier for them to open up and it's less, there's less of the white lab coat phenomenon.
Right.
Going on. And so discovering how powerful those primary care relationships can be when you meet someone, get to know them, and then continue seeing them has been a real revelation. It's led to us, you know, more than 5 years ago, we moved our model, our understanding of the power of virtual primary care, to focus our entire energy as a company on distributing and making available high quality primary care from a doctor delivered entirely virtually, as a complement to the system.
Yeah. Well, like you, I've had a pretty extensive history with telehealth. I was with a system in outstate Nebraska back in the late 90s, early 2000s, where our catchment area was the size of the state of Indiana. And with only 350,000 people, as you could imagine. And so getting the access primarily for those people to specialty care was incredibly difficult. And we started our own telehealth network utilizing our specialists. They became very, very robust. So I've been used to this and I saw the real need for it at that time, obviously in rural healthcare, but now that it's expanded into a more urban environment. So what did the healthcare industry get wrong about digital health in the early days? And what are we finally starting to get right?
That's a really good question, Kevin. I would suggest that one of the things about, you know, bluntly, a profit-driven healthcare system is that businesses will pursue profit opportunities, and where there's a need, someone will fill it. And I would suggest that the various companies that are focusing on filling consumer-driven needs they may be filling an important role, but it's not nearly enough. And many people don't know what they need or aren't looking for the thing that would most help them. And I have taken the position, and the whole company we have is focused on this idea that what people need most, they may not know, but what they need is someone to talk to about their health who actually understands, who can guide them away from the stuff that's nonsense and hype and not needed, and toward the things that actually matter to improve their health. People don't recognize sometimes how simple and straightforward things that would dramatically improve their health can be. And having someone you trust guide you and incentivize you and offer ways for you to actually improve how you're feeling in your life is actually a pretty important task. So what did we get wrong? Too much focus on the business side of what can we operationalize and do at scale to make money on a per transaction basis versus how can we deliver a higher quality of care to everyone by making the first step of access to care more accessible.
Okay. Well, HealthTap was founded before telehealth became really mainstream. So what problem were you originally trying to solve when you launched the company, and how has your mission changed over the years?
Also a really good question. Our mission was to do what we're doing now when we got started. It just wasn't possible yet. We said, it's going to be a big thing. It's going to be important. It's going to be possible to deliver care on mobile devices. It may not be yet, but we want to build the infrastructure and the foundation so we can be there when it is. I mean, as the video codecs didn't exist for high resolution video when we got started in 2010. It was crazy. So we actually got started saying, well, what can we do now? We started with a information service. I invited doctors to participate and allowed people to ask health questions, and doctors gave answers. We built a remarkable network of 100,000 doctors, mostly in the U.S., but also in other countries, where we vetted them individually as doctors and let them answer patient questions. We didn't charge patients to ask the question. We didn't pay the doctors to give the answers. It was an entirely voluntary network, and we were told it would never work, but we had, I mean, I've got 3 million answers written by doctors in our library that demonstrates it can work. And that was how we got started. That was kind of a foundation. We also thought, well, people that have health concerns will start with a question, and then if they actually need more care, then we can deliver the health care from a doctor as a next step. It turns out there's such a demand for health information that that ends up being a totally separate service. And interestingly, 16 years later, we now have a world in which large language models are able to answer most informational questions. They still can't answer, what should I do? What should I do is different from answering an informational question. And it's sort of interesting that the large language models are now able to accurately answer informational questions, but you still need a doctor to get advice about what you should actually do.
Certainly. Okay, as a physician, what frustrates you the most about the traditional primary care model in America today? And if you could redesign it from scratch, what would it look like?
Well, the biggest frustration is just lack of availability and lack of access. Second frustration is that because primary care is underfunded, and because the benefits of primary care do not accrue to the doctor who's delivering the service, things that would be of great value to individuals don't happen. What you see is, especially in the corporate world of corporate practice of primary care, you see emphasis on productivity, they would say, or throughput. And there's a huge pressure to reduce the amount of time the doctor takes with each patient. And that has paradoxically negative effects on both the quality of care and the cost of care. If you incentivize a doctor to figure out what test to order as a means to move on to the next patient, it's as a temporary, if the value, the purpose of the visit is to figure out what I can do right away, what I may do is figure out what test is needed, and then I can order the test and see you back and follow up for another short interaction. That's not good quality care. You know, I'm reminded my mentor in medical school told me that when I finished the history, if I didn't know what the patient had or what the right thing to do was, that means I wasn't finished the history yet. That time connecting with people is the most valuable component. And so recognizing that that's something you can do virtually, and that when you reduce the total cost of the system delivering care, it's possible to spend more time with patients than happens. And so, again, paradoxically or counterintuitively, the virtual interaction can be more relaxed and more in depth than a rapid mill type interaction that often happens. Now, not all doctors are behaving this way. The DPC docs are in a different world for this very reason, rebelling against this corporate notion of productivity and minimum time. So the problem with primary care right now is doctors not being given enough time or allowed to practice the kind of medicine they want to.
No, I would totally agree with that. So many of my physician friends are leaving private practice, leaving medicine as a whole because of their frustration of the intense pressures that they're seeing on the productivity side. One of my physician friends recently shifted over to a concierge model and said, you know, the main reason is I had no life outside of the office. Because each and every day I was expected to see between 40 and 50 patients. And then I was doing the paperwork until 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. And so concierge became the only thing that he said it was either go to concierge or I was going to retire from medicine. And I loved doing what my patient care is what I loved, but it was everything else around it that I didn't like.
Well, and I like to think that we have created an antidote or a counter opportunity for doctors to feel exactly that way. And many of the doctors that join our medical group come from exactly that perspective, looking for a better way of doing care. And it's not the same because you don't get to put your hands on your patients, but it's still remarkable how connected you can be with your patients that you're talking to and guiding to the right answers for their health concerns. So we're seeing doctors who are saying, oh, hey, I've lost all of the hassle. If I'm in a small practice and I'm managing the office, the overhead of management of an office and staff and leasing and so on is huge. Or if I'm a medical group, now I'm facing the pressures of the corporate style push to improve productivity for the group. And what we do on the Health Tab is we take all of that away because we have a virtual care platform that the doctor, it's just there to use. And the doctor gets to spend 100% of their time connecting with their patients and documenting and recommending what to do. We've constructed a platform that sort of self-contains. The doctor can manage their patient care during the time allocated. First visits are always at least a half an hour with patients. Now, some doctors will spend the full amount of time with the patient and then document after. That's fine, but they don't have to. They can, within a 30-minute time frame, they can see the patient and write the note before the next patient comes. And having it electronically makes it easier because you can streamline workflows and reduce the number of clicks. You know, you need to use proper design methods to make the product work efficiently, have the workflow be built around how the doctors think so that it's easier and seamless and intuitive for the doctors to do that too.
Well, absolutely. Again, AI being used as a tool to enhance the experience versus trying to totally change the experience and take the physician out of the equation. So we talked a little bit, you mentioned, the accelerated adoption of telehealth, and COVID certainly did that. So now that we're several years removed from the pandemic, what lessons did healthcare leaders learn, and what lessons are they starting to forget?
What did we learn in the pandemic? There's so many things that happened. There was so much noise around the pandemic. I mean, personally, I learned to think about how you make decisions. I think about it, the fog of war comes to mind. You think about how to make decisions when information is sparse and yet you are compelled to act with dire consequences one way or the other. And so certainly the pandemic led me to think about how do you manage the uncertainty and how do you convey what to do in the face of crisis. But again, that was just the acute crisis of the pandemic. We learned a lot about how misinformation spreads. We learned a lot about how people's fear influences their interpretation of information they get. We learned, I think, about how social media can have negative effects in stoking division and promoting misinformation, frankly. And we learned the vaccines work despite despite the a lot of the continues to this day negative sentiment around how that functions. To your point, we also learned people had their first exposure because they were forced to virtual care. We learned that people learned that, gosh, I got what I needed virtually. It wasn't that easier. And doctors, interestingly, you know, when you're trained and your whole career is centered around one model of delivering care, having it abruptly disrupted by forcing doctors to talk on the phone or do a Skype call with their patients didn't change how they wanted to practice medicine. And they pretty much reverted to their brick and mortar office-based practice. We have structures for compensation for doctors that also reward them for practicing medicine in the office. And so the individual doctors are not incentivized to create a system of efficient care. They're incentivized to deliver care within the structures that they have learned and are comfortable with. And that's completely understandable. And, you know, in the future, I see a model where there's absolutely an incredibly important role for a doctor to put their hands on the patient to be able to manage and examine and also intervene in the physical space. And I see that as that in the future, we need to have a hybrid model where things that can be done virtually should be done virtually. Better, it's faster, it's more accessible, it's more convenient, and it's cheaper. And it's better. It's just if what you need can be delivered virtually, it really should be, because it's inefficient and unnecessary and inconvenient to do it any other way. But at the same time, if you think of virtual care as the first stop, the filter, you get everything you can get done virtually, but you're also, that is an assessment and a triage process where if you need something more, instead of self-selecting to where to go and which specialist to pick to go and see, you have an expert clinician who knows you, who figures out what you need next and guides you to the right care at the right urgency. You don't need to go to the ER. This can be a problem handled in the office next week. You don't need to see a gastroenterologist. Your first stop needs to be a cardiologist. See a orthopedist, you should see a neurosurgeon. Before we do this referral, we're going to do a test to identify what's going on, confirm the issue, and then get you to the right source. So the expert primary care physician guiding patients to the best care has huge benefits in efficiency, effectiveness, and reducing costs because you don't go get unnecessary care. I'm reminded of the patient. I'm wondering if they have GI upset or a cardiac problem. I know that if I send that patient to the cardiologist, they're going to get a cath to answer the question, could this be cardiac? I know that if I send that patient to the gastroenterologist, they're going to get an endoscopy to give the answer. And I've personally done this, but the point being that you want the decision about which doctor to go to be driven by someone who knows and understands what's in the best interest of their patients.
Sure. So you consistently said that technology should augment clinicians rather than replace them. So what does the ideal physician AI partnership look like 5 years from now?
You know, we're in a state of transition. And we can talk about how can the technology in its current state be optimally used. We've taken some steps in that direction too, which I can talk about. But that's a little bit different from the longer term. When you say 5 years or beyond 5 years, we're going to see advances in capability that far exceed what we have available today. So the two very different conversations. How should we use today? And, you know, the adoption rate is so slow that we as physicians think it takes 5 years to take a new well-formed technology and have it actually deployed at scale, 5 to 10 years before things that we know work end up actually happening with some frequency. And interestingly, in 5 years, the capabilities will be so different than they are today that it's going to be a constantly moving target. So I can talk about how we can deploy technology we have today, which is a supportive role for doctors. It's a powerful tool that you think of the large language model as sort of the best reference library to look things up and to remind yourself of things that you might not otherwise have think of. And I can give you an example. I saw a patient in my clinic who had a series of unusual small minor issues wrong with them. And I asked myself, gosh, why is this patient who's a young 40s man having this and that? And that he had a little bit of psoriasis and he had a couple of skin lesions. And then he had an attack of what looked like gout, acute inflammatory arthropathy of his ankle. And he had this intermittent psoriform rash on his, and then he had some blepharitis. I said to myself, there's something going on here. And I'm trying to remind myself of all the things that could cause this set of disparate clinical conditions. And it was so easy to go to Open Evidence and describe the patient and say, what could it be an underlying condition to explain this? And look up, in effect, the world of complicated and rare conditions that might explain all of these disparate conditions. And you know, the answer came out right away. Your patient most likely has Behçet's syndrome. Now, I saw Behçet's when I was in residency. I remember what it is. I could tell you about Behçet's syndrome, but I needed the language model to remind me. And so this notion of the prompt to the doctor to guide and support and provide things to make sure you think about is important. I actually, interestingly, I previously studied this when I looked at the impact of presenting. I did the study where I presented a series of known cases to doctors. And I said, what do you think it is? And I gave them a blank box to fill out. What do you think the diagnosis is? I took the same cases randomly assigned to different doctors. I showed them the case. And in addition to the case, I showed them a list of 10 things that it might be. And the diagnostic accuracy of doctors on the same cases, when prompted with things to think about, went from 63 to 83%. Getting it right. The doctor knew about those conditions. They just weren't thinking of them. And so it highlights the opportunity to remind doctors of things to think about. And if you separate the informational knowledge access from the decision-making and probabilistic preference-driven methods the doctor should be using to figure out what to do next, if you separate the two, you see that right now in the current state, large language models are really good at knowing things and being able to answer questions about what unusual combinations can be in a very exhaustive fashion. They're very, very good at creating differential diagnosis. But somebody has to talk to the patient to get out the information in the first place, to know what's important. And the language models to date are not very good at planning. They're not very good about thinking through what to ask and what's important and what to leave behind and which issues to pursue. And that level of clinical expertise is what the driving force is today for the physician engagement. And then the large language model is a complement to support. Once you gather the information, doctor, you tell me what you think is important, and I'll remind you of things to think about, where the doctor still retains authority to and the expertise to know what things matter and how to proceed, given the different possibilities that exist. Now, in the future, you ask me in 5 years, I don't know how quick it's going to come. But in 5 years or in 10 years, each of those things is going to get incrementally better. And doctors are the ability to know what questions to ask, the ability to pursue the things that are important and leave behind the things that aren't, the ability to understand the difference between something that has dramatic consequences versus something that wouldn't matter. This is something emergency physicians are very good at, right? If you come in with back pain to the emergency department, I'm going to make sure you don't have an aortic aneurysm before I send you home. Even though the chances of that are incredibly small, the consequence of missing it is so severe that you pay attention to it anyway. And it's similar, that kind of thinking is a planning process that isn't the language the AI is not very good at today, but I anticipate in the future it will be good. I anticipate in the future the AI will be able to understand and evaluate what a patient's preferences are for the best approach and attitude to take. Right now, that's nowhere near there. And doctors who rely on what AI advice for what to do is are gravely mistaken. And one of the challenges of current AI is that it's so confident. It appears, it looks good. It's very confident and you want to believe it, but it will be wrong and it may be wrong in disastrous ways. And so it's incredibly important that doctors continue to have the skill to distinguish between the two.
Sure. All right. Last question. You spent your career trying to make healthcare more accessible, more intelligent, and more human through technology. So when people look back 20 years from now, what do you hope they'll say was Jeffrey Rutledge's contribution to medicine and healthcare?
Well, I don't know what the future will hold and how people will actually look back on what I've done, but I would hope they would recognize that the human nature of healthcare is incredibly important, and that Rutledge was someone who configured technology to support the most important aspect of people connecting with a caring resource that actually guides them to a better health, and that the humanity of medicine is the most important thing that we need to hang on to. And even as, you know, as a technology leader, I'd like to think I'm promoting and pushing for the access to technology, but I hope people remember that I was the one who was trying to ground that in the humanity of medicine and the need for people to get care that actually works for them.
Well, Dr. Rutledge, it's been a real honor and a real pleasure to have you on I Don't Care today. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's been my great pleasure to chat. And thank you so much for so much perception and understanding of the field.
Well, thank you so much. Dr. Jeffrey Rutledge, co-founder and chief medical officer of HealthTap and digital health pioneer. I hope you've enjoyed today's conversation on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson, as much as I have. And I look forward to seeing you again next week on our next episode of I Don't Care. Take care.
Thanks so much.